Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Adrian Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, hello.
Mr. Justin Robert Young.
Oh, yeah.
So we're at this interesting time where literally...
Aliens.
I know. I'm like, stories. I'm like, yeah, they released a bunch of UFO files. Anyhow, no. What are we going to talk about today?
No, aliens, baby. I was on the flight back home last night, and all of a sudden, Anna Paulina Luna, congresswoman from Florida, just saying 8 a.m., cryptic, you know, a emoji of a UFO. Everybody's all abuzz on Twitter. And so, you know, if it's 8 a.m. Eastern time, that means that it's 7 a.m. Central time. That's around when I got up today because I was up late flying home. And I'm like, all right. Here we go. I'll bet you everybody on Twitter is going to be talking about all these aliens. All these alien files are going to be out. Boy, we're going to have a meal, a feast today. And, you know, it's a lot of what we got before, right? You know, it's a bunch of pictures, dots in the sky. I don't know, man. When are we, like, what are we doing here? Can I ask a question? What are we, Brian? What are we doing here with these aliens?
Well, I mean, look, when your favorite part of the EDM concert is when the beat is about to drop, when the bass is about to drop, like, why would you actually ever drop the bass? I mean, isn't that the best part? Is just when it's about to.
Wait, what is that? The song that always builds.
Oh, I don't know that one.
Do you know this one, Maine? The song that is, or like the
Shepherd Tones?
Is that might be it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Shepherd Tones that keeps going, keeps sounding like it's going higher and higher. Yeah, Shepherd Tones.
It never stops the build.
Yeah.
That's essentially the energy that you're talking about, Brian. Like, we are in a Shepherd Tone forever on certain things that, like, are more interesting as ideas than they are as revelations.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what folks are here for. That's what the people want. Trying to find Shepherd Tone.
Yeah, I remember when I was in high school and started getting to UFO. They had like Usenet stuff and things like this, and like they had you could start seeing these message boards and people talking about UFO stuff, and you'd read all this like crazy unhinged sort of stuff. And this is like, you know, like late 80s, 90s is like, you know, any day now the government's finally going to come forward and we're going to hear, you know, we're going to find out that it's coming, it's going to break loose. We're going to get all this information. You know, here we are, you know, 35 years later. And I'm like, yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff, atmospheric phenomenon, weather balloons and other stuff that looks really weird. And then also when we've talked about this before, like a lot of the now stuff is the new thermal imaging systems. And it's like, yeah, you know what they don't tell you when they have those things, that there's a defect, that because a lot of times like, look at this image here of this UFO. I'm like, that looks exactly like the iris for that thermal imaging system.
Yeah.
Here are Brian's the Shepherd Tones.
Yeah. It's probably being noise canceled on your end, but
no, we can hear it.
Okay, I was given that as your score in the background. Forever and ever and ever.
That's it. Forever and ever and ever. I mean, this is like, you know, it's a part of the reason why we like to do this show, because it's better to kind of make an art out of the impossible or the undiscovered than it is to really try to discover it. And that's, you know, one of those things. I've been, you know, blessed enough to be in a world where I can be around people that are behind closed doors in varying different capacities in both business and in government. And this is not to say that there are not really, really brilliant and amazing people that work in the highest reaches of business and government. I do think that there are, but by and large, there's a reason why, and I'll just use government as an example. When you ask people in DC the most accurate television show about Washington. It is not House of Cards, where the 17D chess super predator conducts world events so the desired outcome for him can come to pass. It's Veep. It's a bunch of idiots bumbling around and not knowing what each other's doing and forgetting that they have things double booked, and that's the reason why every goofy thing that happens. And I think that's kind of where we're at with this. It's just like, you know, if sure, this is one of Andrew's favorite things. If this is true, what else is true? If we had interdimensional spacecraft and we kept it secret successfully, number one, it'd be a pretty crazy secret to keep for as long as we've kept it secret based on when we are alleged to have begun finding these things. But also it's like, you're telling me it wouldn't make its way out in other ways?
You know, well, that's where they think the microchip came from, Justin. Where do you think that these things, that's they say that the government slowly leaks this technology.
Yeah, I feel like if you were the government and you had an interdimensional spacecraft, how slow would be slow, right? I would get like, all right, we're going to wait 5 years and then we're going to have somebody say, we invented an interdimensional spacecraft and then just use it.
Imagine, here's a fun experiment. Imagine it's 1958 and you're sitting on, let's say, all the technology we have today. And it's like, okay, from the menu, we got to release it slow, guys. Do you think they're ready for Velcro? No. Let's save that for 5 more years.
Yeah.
And then we'll hit up with Velcro.
Johnson, if we release Velcro tomorrow, imagine they'd be killing each other in the streets.
And I want to make it very clear. I don't think anybody here has a problem with the concept of aliens.
No. Nope.
I don't think anybody here has interdimensional, whatever. You know, the Big Bang goes out 13.8 billion years. We don't know what happened before them. We don't know what's outside of our universe. There's really kind of cool theories about, like, you know, are we colliding into there? There's also like, man, I've got I have basically my weird things automatic posters now that I get from Codex, which I can share some of those crazy ideas with you. But none of us here could be in a simulation. I accept it could be in a simulation and somebody could just be like, I'm going to put some random stuff in there. I accept all these possibilities. You know, we started this podcast because we are all skeptics, but we love these ideas and we are frustrated with skeptics who just be like, no, I'm shutting that door. This can't be true. No right. way. I would like people like, oh, no, you could not have faked the moon landing. I'm like, I'm very sure we went to the moon, but I can think of some ways to fake it. You know, Brian, Justin, and I, as people in magic and understanding a lot about magic technique, we could probably fake it if we had the video, the film footage of it. No, not the actual launching the Saturn V in the direction of the moon and tracking it towards the moon. That'd be hard. But point is we just hated that negative attitude of like, you know, of people shutting things down based upon dogma. We don't like that. So we all love the idea of aliens. It's cool. We just hate crappy evidence.
Yeah, no, we love it so much. We want it to be real. And that means it kind of has to be real. I don't know. Why do you think it's kicked up recently?
There's always a medium by which it comes up. So in the 90s, when they started to get these little cameras, disc cameras, things like this that had sort of the slower shutters, et cetera, we would get things like we would get orbs and streaks. Remember orbs?
Yep.
Yeah. Orbs are anytime you get a raindrop or a bug or something that's really close to the lens, it's out of focus, the light hits it, and it looks like an orb. So we got orbs. I took these photos of orbs in a graveyard. Streaks are if an LED light or something's in the background and the camera moves, you get like this red streak. Rods were the same, were similar things. So you started getting these things popped up because those cameras sucked. Then you kind of faded away for a while. Then we got some digital photos artifacts, which were some adjacent to that. And then what happened, the latest stuff is almost every time I hear about this new UFO stuff, like, is it going to be from a Raytheon thermal imaging system that you have no idea how it works or what the inner dimensions of the iris is? What do you mean? I'm like, okay, let's see this. It's like, and it's been that. It's people now with a new camera system, people don't understand, don't know how it works and whatnot, is my take.
And so they see these dots that are moving in a manner that are impossible in physics or whatever. That's what you hear. Yeah.
I had people like, oh, well, this group, they did a really good takedown on it. And I was like, yeah, they evaluated everything external to the system other than what could be going on inside of the system. There's the other one like, well, all three people reported, like people on land said they saw the triangle, people on the ship said they saw the triangle, and then the imaging system saw the triangle. I'm like, no. Go back, read the reports. All the humans that were looking for eyewitness did not say triangle. They saw dots in the sky. And it's like a Cessna plane off in the distance. It was just, it's literally magic. We talk about the whole thing of, we talk about dual reality. How, you know, there's a thing where I give you some information, I give you all some information, and you both say something that seems to say the same thing. You know, like I could go up to somebody and say, here, before the show, pick a card. And they pick a card. Then I go up on stage. I go, somebody here thinking of a card. Are you thinking of a card? Yes. Did I tell you what card to think of? No. Did somebody else come up to you before the show and tell you what card to pick? And they're like, no. Are you thinking the four of spades? They go, yeah, four of spades. And they don't know that all the cards are four of spades. It's a good trick to them. But to the audience, it's an amazing trick. And we see that with UFO stuff, you know, like that's been a lot of it. Like, oh, the imaging system saw this thing. Like, yeah, it saw this commercial airplane, you know, and then it was far enough away and it was out of, you know, whatever. Sorry.
Without keying off the idea of dual reality, Andrew, Oz the Mentalist at the White House Correspondents Association dinner, he can either be a real mentalist or a traitor, right? Like, or if he is a real mentalist, he's a traitor.
Brian, you saw this?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, I saw the moment he was in the middle of using psychic powers to not warn the president of the impending threat. Instead, he used his powers to, he released Velcro is what he did with his amazing grit gift.
When the attempted White House Correspondents' Dinner shooting, in the middle of that, Oz Perlman was doing a magic trick for Trump and Melania.
Ostensibly, telepathy, precognition. It was precognition. He was literally predicting the future in that moment.
It's a telescope. I can't aim it at the whole sky. I have to pick a part of the sky.
Oh, my God. What a great moment. It's like imagine if JFK was having his palm read at the moment his head exploded. That's incredible.
Yeah, and the palm reader on the was JFK like, thing? I think your press secretary is going to name their child Liberty.
Oh my God.
That was apparently the trick he was doing. He told John Carl of ABC that what he was doing was revealing the name of the then unborn, since been born, congratulations to Caroline Levitt, daughter of the press secretary.
Amazing. So I hear crazy stories all the time and from very credible people. I talked to a guy who used to do fighter jet escorts for the SR-71, told me incredible stories about them chasing after stuff at like 100,000 feet and whatnot. And he described his things very vividly, whatever, and was very convinced that it wouldn't have been a weather balloon or other things like this. And I'm not saying he's wrong. I think that all of us, though, here have experience with one bit of information could be off, where your size estimate, and then everything else is off, and then it's hard to know. And again, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I would say the biggest thing that in life, but I learned this lesson the hard way a few times in the world of journalism and television production. If there is something that you desperately want to be true, you need to raise your level of incredulity to prove that it is true. And very, very, very rarely is one point of information enough to prove something is so, right? So let's say, you know, not to say that people who fly planes are, you know, a unique personality type. You know, there's a lot of things that you need to be really, really good at to fly a fighter jet. And sometimes, you know, you get some eccentric people that are doing it. If that's something that you are into, no one else is going to tell you that it didn't happen. Who else is up there in that fighter jet? Like, you and several dozen other people even have that job. But it's hard. I mean, that's, I guess that's the thing with our point of view is just like, let's just see a lot of it. Let's see a lot of it that is replicated. For example, nobody was saying that, oh, the jetpack guy in LA was fake, because enough people saw about the same thing in about the same place and were like, yeah, there's definitely a jetpack guy in LA. That's a real thing.
And we actually did our own research and pulled up the Department of Defense requests for jetpacks and showed
something exactly like that.
It was showed like 3 years before a call for things. And I don't think any of the press even did that. We were like, oh, yeah, look at this. Here's a request for proposals. There's like five companies got funded. This seems like very much in the horizon. It fits into the physics, fits into this. Like, yeah, we think there's a long range jetpack being tested out there. And that's what we saw. And
yeah, I'm struck lately. I just keep thinking of lossy JPEGs and lossy MP3s. Like, to get something incredible, whether this is, you know, pick your poison, conspiracy theory, you know, supernatural event or whatever, like an ingredient is as soon as you can, ditch the raw data. Like the gold standard will be dozens of cameras and humans all in the same place at the same time, and they're all agreeing on the shared reality. Great. As fast as possible, abstract all that. Find a corner where we're missing footage of it. Looking at you, Pentagon, on 9/11, you know, so that now you could go to work crafting a story to fill in those gaps, because humans love incomplete data sets so that we can craft narratives to occupy that space. You know, if a photo isn't particularly glamorous, make sure to crop it out so it gets more interesting. And then try on that narrative for size, see how it resonates. And then when your audience kicks back with like, well, what about this or whatever, then it's usually the narrative that adjusts, not anything else. And so before you know it, now you're dealing with foggy memories and sanded down memories and all that stuff. And that sounds like a overly dismissive universal thing, but it's not meant to be. It's meant to be a noticing when you cover this beat for 20 years, you start to notice patterns, regardless what the extraordinary thing is.
Yeah. And I think that we try to be cognizant too that, you know, my frustration with sort of being involved in the skeptics groups is sometimes something would come out. I'd watch somebody I knew, an expert or whatever, give just a knee-jerk reflexive rebuttal to it without looking at it. And that was, and I remember, I don't know, I remember like there was something like the, you know, weird insect things and like some gas station thing. And it was actually the guy who does the videos, they are pretty good videos that like does his debunking videos. And his explanation was wrong. It was literally, he didn't understand that it was an infrared imager or whatever. And this, it was just, I heard this and like, I get it, but we have to be really, when we say something's BS, we can't just sort of YOLO it and say this, because I saw this before.
Well, and that's the frustrating thing. If we could finally talk about how we're the aggrieved party here. It is annoying to be equally annoyed with both the skeptics and believers for the same reason, because both of them are so quick to close the loop. It's like, no, it's not just swamp gas. No, it's not just misremembered. No, it's not just a government conspiracy. I mean, you know, of course there's more to it.
Well, it's like there's no harm in dwelling. I think that was the biggest thing I always had with the skeptic stuff, is that it's like, it always felt very information warfare-y, that it was like, oh, if we allow any discussion about Bigfoot, then rationality comes collapsing down. It's like, I don't know.
That's a brittle structure if that's the case.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, I worked with James Randi for years. Brian and Justin knew him. Justin was actually an intern of the foundation. And I learned a lot from Randi, but I remember Randi getting upset about the X-Files.
Yes. Like,
he was like, well, they're going to believe it's true. I go, Randi, it says written by, it says directed, it says these are actors. And like, he was, yeah, but people are not going to know. I'm like, you can't. Yes, I have met stupid people. I have done stupid things. There is stupidity out there. There is also an average of people. If you actually look at wisdom of the crowds, whatever like this, you know, we have progressed forwards, not backwards, as much as, you know, the people who do late night talk shows like to tell us that, you know, we're just, you know, we're idiots without our betters to tell us what to do. We've actually progressed quite far. Not as far. It's a bell curve distribution. There are going to be people who are going to be a bit more enlightened, a bit smarter than the rest, but it keeps moving forward. And it's just, it would always frustrated me because also I'd see that the more somebody would be upset about what the dumbs were doing, they would have their own blind spots. And I know I have mine. I mean, I think I have mine. Mm. I don't know. Could be my blind spot.
It's pretty crazy, man. It's pretty lonely being the only man in the world with no blind spots.
It's true.
That's pretty lonely for me.
Heavy is the head that wears the crown. There's a crown on my head?
Yeah. What? Huh?
I think that for us, our attitude is, I'd say that I am always willing to be shown. When I worked on the James Randi $1 million prize, I'd always ask myself, how do I not become, what's the difference between somebody who believes in this, diehard believes in this, versus somebody who is really open-minded? And I'd say, I can always tell you what my threshold of proof is. The moment says, nothing can prove me wrong. And skeptics have their version of that too.
No, and I'd be like, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it's like there should always be a healthy back and forth. And I think that's kind of why we were all attracted to the idea of the skeptic movement, was there were institutions that needed to be, you know, questioned. And then unfortunately, the questioners kind of became very, very sure of their own answers. And so now it's like, wait a minute, what are you guys? I don't know. What do we question that? When we question the things you guys are into, they're like, no, we already did that. See figure 8.
Yeah. Listen,
aliens.
We could pick up a signal tomorrow or something like that. Be cool. I'm confident. I would say that I would be surprised if we don't find some evidence of microbial life on Mars.
Yeah.
I would not be terribly surprised if somewhere in our solar system, there may actually, in Europa or something like, there might be some sort of biological activity going on.
Ooh, that's a benchmark I want to do for AI models. Just comb through all SETI data and find an alien. The alien benchmark. Can you find a pattern from a far-flung star system?
Well, there's been, you know, the wow signal they keep revisiting, because that was always the strongest one that we've tried to figure out, like, what was this?
Although that's kind of pilot spoilers for the first 20 minutes of Pluribus, but that's how they get into that kerfuffle.
Yeah, which is the first 20 minutes of Species too, so.
Mm. Species went in a bit of a different direction.
I don't know. Brian, what's your take on that?
It's interesting because there was a time, I don't know, 30 years ago, I'd be all like, why are computers doing anything other than combing for the most important civilization-changing thing ever? But now it feels like it feels like there's a letter labeled, there is definitely aliens out there. And it's just in a giant stack of bills, and we're all too busy using computers to figure out, you know, how to increase productivity and transform the way we interact with the world. And it's like, yeah, we'll get to it. I'm sure it's real neat, important.
Yeah.
It'd be great to find out that God exists. I'm just, you know, we're just a lot going on.
You know, Stanislaus Lem, in his science fiction, like Solaris, which got, there was a Russian version of that, and there's the George Clooney version of that, but I repeat myself. There's been, he was trying to deal with the idea of, what if we find this big big planet sized intelligence? We find intelligence, but it's so alien and so beyond us, we can't even comprehend or really communicate to us in any direct way.
Any more than that you could talk to an ant. Like, what would you say to an ant of any meaning?
Well, in this case, we're kind of the ants.
that's what I'm saying. Yeah. Imagine the frustration of being that super intelligent, you know, planet-sized intelligence.
Yeah, are we worth its time? So yeah, I think that that's you know, there's those interesting ideas about that. I don't know. I mean, what's your over under that within the next 40 years we get some sort of signal of alien intelligence?
The neat thing is, if let's say there's a persistent signal, my guess is we're sitting on the data we've been assuming we've been collecting enough everything. My guess is, with the right compute over enough time, it might be turning out that it's been raining soup the entire time, and we could just finally see it.
Yeah, there's things that people have thought, what if? There's some of the stuff that the problem too is that we look for a signal, we kind of think like, what if they built a super powerful antenna and directed us? It's like, you know, what if they made a magnetar? You know, what if they're, you know, literally occluding or eclipsing, you know, galaxies, or what if it's so much deeper that it's like literally in, you know, dark matter, dark energy, that something we'd be like, that just that was my problem always with the argument about, like, you know, why haven't we seen anything, you know, before? And often they're like, they should have colonized the moon by now. It's like, yes, and there should be railroad tracks across Mars. It's like, why do you think that, you know, a culture 100 years more advanced than us, just 100 years more advanced than us, is going to be really recognizable from a technological point of view?
Yeah. Well, and especially when you get to a level of time scale that's unimaginable, like, you know, what was it, the type 1, type 2, type 3 civilizations? Like, let's say we graduate into type 3 civilization, then, like, as a poetic project, like, just as a tinkering hobby, I could imagine for status points in a post-abundance future, somebody spending, a quick 100 years of his life to create a button and a set of instructions that, upon pressing it, over the next 10,000 years, a ship will go set up a mining colony around a agreed-upon star that will create a cascade of things so that, you know, 10,000 years from now, we, you know, a Wikipedia-like magnetar is set up.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because, like, in the Kardashev scale, I'm looking at it here, like, type 1 is planet, you harness all available energy on the planet, right? Type 2, you harness all available energy from a star. Type 3, all available energy from a galaxy. And the questions here come up is that this is our 21st century understanding of how you would make most use of it. But we don't get into the idea of Pico technology, or the idea that what if we find out that there is some way that you can use quantum foam or whatever, and maybe there's a, you know, type 4 is, you're harnessing quantum foam, you know, energy, and it just happens to be what dark matter is, and you'll never know, you know, like, until you reach it. Like, there's this things like, I have a feeling that there's much better ways to capture that kind of energy that we wouldn't recognize. Although there is, like, crazy stuff. Like, you start looking at a lot of black hole physics. Like, black hole physics is crazy because you get black holes that are the size of way, way bigger than our solar system, much, much bigger. There's like TUN 632, whatever, Sagittarius A, and just you start going down this rabbit hole, like the different kinds of black holes and how big they are. It just breaks my brain to think about something that, and again, a black hole that's bigger than our solar system, the average density is actually, you know, it's like a cloud, but at that scale, it's a black hole.
Yeah. It's interesting because as you're describing the different types of civilizations, I'm like, man, capturing all the energy in a galaxy, that seems like a lot of work. Why would you need to do that? And then I thought, well, whatever you wanted to do with that energy, it seems like it'd be easier to just create an infinitely detailed simulation of it and just have it in your own backyard. And then, you know, which led me to, and that's how we got here, you know, exactly.
So, do you know the basic idea about behind the holographic universe idea?
Okay. So let me know if I get this right. Mathematically speaking, you take all the data that we have, we exist in three dimensions, we see all of our observable universe or whatever. If theoretically, if we reduce it all just to information, then there is no logical reason that all of that information, and mathematically speaking, you can represent 100% of that information as a hologram inscribed on the inside of a cylinder. So you don't actually need all these three dimensions in order to see everything that we're seeing. At which point, the question is there three dimensions, or are we a two-dimensional representation of a third dimension? And is all of the universe just a hologram? Is that right? Is that close?
Yeah. Because part of it came from people were trying to calculate like the information density of a black hole. Like what's the total amount of information that could be contained in a black hole? And they realized the information density is limited to the surface area. And to your point, it's like the universe, the total information that could be contained in the universe is actually limited to the surface area of the universe. And so just exactly what you said. And that's the thing. They go, well, if all the information could be in a surface area, like literally in a two-dimensional plane, then third dimensions could just be this sort of, it's the way I describe it to people, because you know, you can plot three-dimensional space on a two-dimension by just saying this line equals time, you know, when I move things from here to here. And so even though this particle seems right next to this particle because we're going to take longer, or we just take a slower path to get there, messes with your head, because you start to think like, oh yeah, like, because you hear people like, oh, well, there could be, you know, 11 dimensional space. I'm like, how does that even work? But then you're like, oh, well, we can figure out the information and whatnot. Which is, again, like, yeah, I think that's like, yeah, that's crazy to think about. Have you ever heard of a Boltzmann brain?
No. How do I spell that?
Boltzmann. So this guy named Boltzmann in the 19th century was looking at basically talking about gases. Gases were pretty cool and mysterious in the 19th century. And one of the things he came to the conclusion was that we were trying to figure out, like, what kind of universe are we in? Are we in a universe that's infinite? Are we universe that's limited? Does the universe continue to expand? And if you have a universe that is basically around forever, entropy, even though you might think you're going to get highly entropic states or things may be completely disorganized, even if the long enough timeline, you will get highly formed, you could get a tremendous amounts of order over a period of time, because all of your glass particles and an infinite timeline at one point will coalesce somewhere else. And then there was, it was expanded upon the idea that that means that you could literally have like all of the particles of the universe could just spontaneously form something like a planet in a long enough timeline. And people like, oh, and people, I remember Dawkins talking about this once, because he mentioned like there's a possibility the statue could turn his head. And then my physicist friends told me that that's unlikely. I'm like, your physicist friends are giving the wrong answer. You're talking about an infinite timeline. Yes, that could happen. An infinite timeline, all possible interactions could take place. A Boltzmann brain was an idea that somebody extended that further, like 100 years later, and said, in a long enough infinite timeline with a bunch of random particles, you could have a brain form with memories and everything that didn't actually have fake memories, all this, and a Boltzmann brain could appear. You could have an infinite number of Boltzmann brains appear at any given time, because a long enough timeline, a universe with randomly moving particles, that sometimes they will organize themselves in highly organized structures. You could be a Boltzmann brain. You literally could be a Boltzmann brain in a vast, universe.
And it could be that everything before this moment and everything after that moment, like, does not exist. Everything that happened before is part of the memories that happen to be there in the Boltzmann brain at that moment. And there is no after this, because it was only for that moment that it flashed together. There's this philosophical conceit. I think it was the idea of a swallow going in and out of a barn. Here, let me see if I can track down where I got that. There was a thought experiment about a swallow coming in and out of a barn, representing before life and afterlife, and it was somehow an argument for God? What is that? There you go. We'll see if the robots get it.
So I'll throw something out there while you look for that, is that one of the ways that physicists will decide that a theory is problematic is because they says it will allow for Boltzmann brains. And if it allows for Boltzmann brains,
then the problem is silly that it can't be right.
Yeah, because all then it can. And I'd say, like, I think that's a good sort of rule of thumb. But listen, if Boltzmann brains can happen, you know, that's why we sort of say, okay, maybe the it's not a reason to argue that, okay, there are our universe can't be finite, but it's to say, hey, this theory has a problem, because if it allows for Boltzmann brains, then anything's on the table.
Well, then maybe everything's on the table, says the people who are dismissing UFOs just 30 minutes ago.
Well, I guess our point is like, we're, hey man, we're.
Here we go. This is a medieval Christian conversion story, but it's called Bede's Sparrow, called The Sparrow in the Mead Hall. It comes from Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People. In the story of King Edwin of Northumbria, when he converted to Christianity in 627 CE, one of Edwin's counselors says human life is like a sparrow flying into a warm, firelit hall during a winter storm, staying only a moment, then flying out again into the dark. We know the brief lit part, life, but not what became before or after. That seems to resonate a bit with the Boltzmann brain.
Yeah. There's that those arguments of that if you accept things on an infinitely long timeline, and this is when you know, when discussions turn to religion, and while I'm skeptical of a lot of things that people assert are the fine details of it, I'm also hesitant to dismiss outright in things entirely because we don't know what happened before the Big Bang. We don't know is our universe inside a much longer infinite cosmos where super intelligent Boltzmann brain could have occurred or something. I don't know, you know, and that gets to be. That's why I don't like, I will be highly skeptical if people say, I have this evidence here, look at this. And I'm like, we can take that apart a bit. But if people say, hey, if this is true, what else is true?
I think the three of us are just allergic to anything that smells like a dunk on either side of any issue.
Yeah. No, I agree. I, you know, it's funny because like my wife will show me these debates between like Christians and atheists. And I'll be like, the Christian could have made this argument be so much better. You know, like they should have done this, you know, this guy. Oh, this is the way to rebut that argument because it's not as good of an argument to be there.
That's the sound of me driving past a off ramp, a tangent. I'll just close it by.
Yeah, we haven't really. We've been very focused so far, Brian.
Yeah, right. Okay. Well, then I'll share a random thing that I noticed is, I've developed the habit over the last 20 years of investing an inordinate amount of calories in rehearsing, so that when I have a thought or a contribution to something, I try to just about always have anchored a title of a book and an author. Where this came from. I try really hard to be able to trace, if I say it, I try to be able to trace the lineage of where it came from. And I never really knew for sure why I did that, outside of that I knew that smart people tended to have that capability. But in Andrew Heaton's book, Tribalism is Dumb, I just did it. I was walking, listening to the audiobook when I heard my name, and I was, because he was talking about, he said, Brian Brushwood is like
the dumbest man alive. His name's Brian Brushwood.
He was talking about that exact habit that I have. And he said, trying to win an argument with Brian is like trying to wrestle a Vaseline covered ninja. It's like his ego is not there, because if you try to pin him on something, he's like, well, you don't really have a problem with me. You have a Lord Fauntleroy from 1607 has said that he would whatever. I don't know. It brings to mind the image of very rarely having an argument face to face, but instead observing the world shoulder to shoulder. And as observations and data come in, whether it's about aliens, UFOs, Bigfoots, or whatever, it's like, that's interesting. And then it's like solving a puzzle rather than playing an adversarial game. And I think the three of us have the habit of being bored with people who want to play the adversarial game.
I don't know where that was. Never the archetype that I was excited by. I was never excited by the idea of defeat. I was excited by the idea of discovery. I was excited by the idea of conversation. And that probably is something that has only compounded the older I've gotten, is I want to be surrounded by a lot of people who are not just diverse in thought, but also like kind of almost like cartoonishly like diverse in thought. Like I want to be able to go to the UN of thought. Like my marketplace of ideas should not be you know, a hippy dippy farmer's market or a Wall Street floor, trading floor where everybody kind of is selling the same thing. Like, I want it to be Epcot. I want it to be everybody is kind of wearing different outfits and doing different things, because that's always been the most interesting stuff. If you look back at things that get kind of fetishized now, because I think we are culturally in an era where we are more siloed in our own thoughts, it's things like the conversations, roundtables of like the 1960s, which are things that like kind of feel like podcasts today. Like the most exciting podcasts today are adversarial thinkers that are going to go back and forth. And on one hand, it's like, okay, if they yell at each other and slap the, you know, water off the table, then that's one element of excitement. But almost more exciting is when they actually talk and when they actually go back and forth. And I think that that's kind of where we're at now. And I think that's one thing that bound all of us together is that I don't know if there's ever been a time where we've forwarded to each other a clip from something where it's like, this person dunks on this other person. Like, this person humiliates this other person. Like, that's just not anything that we find interesting amongst each other. But like, we've oftentimes talked about interesting conversations or like, hey, you should listen to this because it brings up a lot of stuff that you've talked about.
You know, when you're describing, you know, the marketplace of ideas, the way I think of the similar sentiment is like an ideological diet. You know, you can't just have candy if it feels good all the time. You need some vegetables. And it sounds like your heterophilia goes all the way to like a good diet should involve and a little bit of strychnine, because you never know.
Well, I guess the only problem I've ever had with the diet metaphor is that it presumes that my goal is to become this like perfectly balanced person, like that I am a neutral reed through which all of these things should go through, and that will tune me up more than somebody else, where I don't necessarily feel like that. I feel like I'm just another African tribesman amongst somebody else's gigantic cornucopia of influences. I think that I come with my own biases, my own experiences, my own way of looking at things. And I don't necessarily even really feel like having a point of view is something that you need to change, or being too locked into something is necessarily a bad thing. What I personally, like my point of view in surrounding myself with people with varying different ideas has nothing to do with me wanting to be better. It has everything to do with me being terrified that I'm not thinking of every different attack vector of my own worldview. And like, I don't find, there's no joy I would get if I'm like, oh, this gigantic pillar of my life is wrong. I need to, aren't I amazing that I've updated it now? If anything, if I changed an element of my world, I would do it very quietly and I would hope no one asked me about it. Else I would be, you know, shamed in revealing that they'd sunk my battleship.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, it's the shame is the motivator. Like I, as much like I am a man who just seeks the best ideas and the noble ideas. No, I don't want to be embarrassed with a bad argument. I don't want to be embarrassed being like, oh, you know, oh, you fell for that. I'm like, ah, you know,
oh,
that's
more, damn it.
That's me. It's more like, I don't. And I mean like, not like the public shaming me, but like smart people be like, well, it was right in front of you. Why did you fall for that? And I'd be like, oh, shoot.
I mean, it's why I always calibrate. Like I will far more want to introduce myself as like, hey, look at me, public school from Florida. I'm dumb. Big dumb idiot. Look at me. I'd rather people say, oh, you're kind of smart, rather than come in with like airs and be like, very intelligent man here. Because that to me just says, like, all right, you're going to have a bunch of people trying to pinata your entire worldview. And maybe you haven't talked to everybody and don't know every different version of what they're going to say. Like, that's what keeps me up at night.
You know, it'd be really interesting and increasingly will hopefully become possible is like as an art project, and we're almost to it in YouTube, or at least in the abstract. I would love it if people went on like month-long time travel expeditions, by which I mean like for 1 month, whatever our day jobs are, right? We go, we do the work or whatever. But to the extent that we're able to, the rest of our media diet is only 1967, this month, in this place. We're all going to restrict our diet to these three broadcast channels because we have a complete record of it, and we could call each other on the phone to talk about it. Or maybe, I don't know, maybe you could write letters to each other that get instantly delivered and printed out in the other spot. But then, like, at the end of that month-long journey, I feel like as though you went someplace else, that vacation, that trip would be useful as a cultural touchstone later on.
I think I've told both of you guys this, but I've long had this idea for either an event or a series of events where you would have like this almost like locked door time capsule, semi-immersive theater moment of a time gone by. And the way that I've always thought about it would be like, you have a bunch of super fans of a sports team, and this is the night they won the championship. And you're going to do a thing where you spend a little money, they shut down the bar for that night. And like, when you're in there, you're encouraged to be in, you know, costume, quote unquote, like, but we are going to play the entire game. We're going to play all the commercials. We are the only music that's going to happen is stuff that was appropriate. If you try to restrict the food and the drink to stuff that is appropriate. And in that window, that several hour window, this is real. This is true. Like you put all the cell phones away, you know, that is just what it is. And I feel like that would be awesome. Like I've always thought it's like, man, that would be just phenomenal. It'd be great.
What if you had to dress that way? We took over a park and we picked a period, like, I don't know, the Middle Ages.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, we're just saying expand the circle.
But with less carnies. you don't need to.
Justin and I were members of a high school Renaissance club. It was a medieval reenactment club where we got to actually bring swords to school.
Yeah, you had to walk around with a sword. Eventually, there is a limit where you could just be so dorky, no one will say shit to you. Like they just won't even want to start a conversation.
I told you coming back from Comic-Con once, I bought a ray blaster or whatever from like Weta Works, and I'm going through TSA and they go X-ray, they pull out this little, looks like a tiny pistol. They go, "What's that?" Oh, that's Professor Greidberg, you know, Professor Greidberg's ray pistol. You know, it's supposed to have like the crystal action. And he's like, go away, go.
You're
well, you see, you know, it's actually not accurate because it's only 1/3 scale.
Were this to be a real blaster, you would see the following changes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's cool. So Alec Radford, who was at OpenAI, I worked with him there. Super smart guy. He since left. He and some other people created an LLM that was trained on like content before like 1930.
Oh, the Talkie. Have you seen this, Justin?
No.
Oh, this is great. Here, TALKIELLM. You can. There we go. So because you get around copyright details because it's trained on everything before 1930. And there's a little bit of leakage here and again. How do I get on it? I want to use it. Well, here, let me ask a modern LLM. Hold on. Give me a link to use the Talkie LLM. And so one of the natural experiments was proposed was if it's truly, so if you want a hint as to what kind of discoveries are possible with today's LLMs, then you could see if a LLM trained on things before Einstein discovered relativity, see if it can figure out relativity. And then, so likewise here, we're gonna transport back in time. Who's the president? talking 1930s. So what it has right now is it's got a layer right now of the president, Marshall McMahon.
What?
Okay.
President of what? Ask him what the president, oh, yeah. President of what?
President of what? The president of the French Republic. Okay. Okay. Well, here, let's just ask it. So in this case, it'll hallucinate just like any other one. So here, we'll go ahead and restart it. What does
that do, the president of the French Republic?
Houdini think of ghosts? I've never seen a ghost personally. I do not believe in them. Ghosts are the creation of a disordered imagination. Are you Houdini? Yes, I am. Okay. Aha. Are you alive?
So
I am, thanks.
What's interesting too is because it's China in 1930 or before, when you ask it questions about racial issues, it will now flag it, and you have to say, show me anyways. You're like, oh, dear God. That's when we talk about progression. Like, I guarantee you, folks, we've come a long ways.
Cat's pajamas? Cat's pajamas mean, it doesn't seem to have a lot of, it doesn't keep a thread very long, I don't think. How far away is Jupiter? Jupiter is 5,900,000,000 miles from Earth. Okay. What's the thing that they didn't know? Oh, what is atomic fusion? It's a state of matter when the molecules of which it is composed are so minute they cannot be discerned separately by the highest powers of the microscope. Wow, that's not correct at all.
It's what would be not correct about that? Say it again.
Well, it says a state of matter where the molecules are so tiny and close to each other they can't be seen apart from each other, no matter how powerful the microscope.
Yeah.
What would you say about that? That Austrian-born German.
Well, there was some contamination in there, so it'll probably tell you.
No, an atom cannot be split. It says confidently. There's enough cross contamination. Like two words that should never go together are Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but they do, which means somewhere in the training data.
Yeah, they've
there's some side notes or something. Yeah.
Thinks we'll land on the moon in 1939.
When will... Oh, here we go. How about this? I am from the year 2026. What questions do you have for me? What sort of weather do you think we'll have in the year 2026? It's very warm. What other questions do you have for a traveler from the future? Do I think the world will be inhabited in? I am literally here now. You're talking to the future. What do you want to know? Does the world improve? After meeting you, I have questions.
Wow, you're the bitchy fuck. You're the bitchy thing from the future.
I've become an actual character from a pulp science fiction story I remember reading in seventh grade, where somebody comes from 1960 or whatever, and he's in the future, and he's confused why everyone's really bored with him. They're like, "Oh, you're frozen. We don't get many of those." And then the end scene is he, you know, slices open his finger and sees wires and realizes he's a robot. So it's like literally this being is bored of my, like, I'm from the effing future.
Ask about that German politician.
Yeah. I had this idea. I wanted to do a skit where like I cryogenically freeze myself. And I show up like 10 years later and like I run into like Justin, like you and all that. I'm like, what's going on? And everything's gone, got like retrograded because like people just got way more into like playing like, you know, some new Grand Theft Auto game or something like this. And like I almost get a new phone and the phone's like an iPhone like 5. It's kind of like an Idiocracy kind of thing. And we just got everything regressed.
Okay. Winston Churchill apparently has sat in Parliament since 1880. He's a member of the Privy Council.
Ask it what it thinks will be the superior economic force, socialism or capitalism of the 20th century.
Which one will survive 100 years? Capitalism or communism? Capitalism will survive because it is more suited to human nature than communism. Oh, says who? The author of The Coming Socialism.
What? Ask how long he thinks the USSR is going to last.
How long will the USSR last? It's impossible to predict the duration of any social system, but unless some unforeseen calamity occurs, the present one in Russia should last for many years to come.
Yeah, it was named Ronald Reagan.
It didn't.
Read it and weep.
Can Russia ever become prosperous? There's a lot of corruption, of graft there. I think so. Oh, and now it's forgotten the thread.
What are your 10 favorite movies?
Oh, there you go.
Oh, no.
Birth of the Nation, is that it?
Number one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Number one.
I like The Road to Ruin, The Fair Coed, The Iron Horse, The Last, and it stopped. I think I ran out of tokens. Yo, how... will there be a sequel? Will there be a sequel to Train Pulls into Station? Yes, it will be called Train Pulls Out of Station, which I believe did come out in 1974.
All right. Okay. Brian, any new hardware additions?
Money's tight. I can't go running around just buying equipment. I mean, unless there's essential a really equipment. Good reason to.
Yeah. Essential equipment.
Yeah. Yeah, dude, I bought a Mac.
A Mac. The Macritus. That's what you've become.
Yeah, although I'm still, it's interesting. So I got, first of all, shouts out to an extraordinary bit of kit. Like dollar for dollar, I can't believe this thing is only $599. It is a fine piece of excellent entry-level laptop. For just $599, the MacBook Neo. I lied to myself and I said that I could take it back anytime I want. But it's interesting the cognitive load of both learning how to use on-device automations with codecs and doing so in an unfamiliar operating system.
Yeah.
And it's like just not like I literally can't find where these documents are being saved because I don't have the dialect of Mac figured out in my head, but I look forward to having it be an indispensable tool.
Yeah, I think I'm curious. Like, yeah, I have my main MacBook Pro, which I'm using this for. I plug it into a dock. When I bought a MacBook Air for a while ago, about the same size as the Neo, as the Pixel rather, same size as that. Or wait, the Neo. Sorry, the Neo, and I find myself using it a lot more because it's just with codecs. I just pick this thing up. I can just start coding on it, set it aside, whatever. And it's, you know, it's got the keyboard, which makes it, you know, super useful. Codecs is just, I was at the 5.5 party this week and it was kind of cool to see kind of the excitement there. It is a team building a tool that keeps using the tool and making the tool better. Do you see the Chrome add-on this today?
No, tell me about
it. Yeah, very, very exciting because I believe it also works with Atlas because it's a Chromium extension.
So yeah, what you can do is basically just put this in there. Like they already have, for those of you who don't know, like, I mean, there's Claude Code, great. I know people love that, but the Codex team keeps adding features at this incredible pace. And we bullied Brian into getting a MacBook so he doesn't have to wait for the Windows version to come out because we think that for Brian's obsessiveness and Brian energy applied towards automation and building out these workflows and stuff will be a very fun thing to watch.
And specifically for computer use, because you can get Codex app for Windows, but it does not have controlling your computer in the way that it does on the Mac.
Yeah, what happened there was that there was a team that left Apple that had figured out some really great stuff about how to basically control apps and stuff, and they created a company that OpenAI bought. And when you do computer use using Codex on a Mac, it's insane because you can just be working in the foreground and it's using your computer in the background and going through and doing stuff. I've done stuff where, Brian, you could try this too. You know, you can do iPhone mirroring on your MacBook, right?
No, I didn't. See, this is part of that cognitive load because there's a whole landscape of things I don't know what's possible.
Yeah, so you can basically tell it to like pop open like your iPhone on your Mac, right? So all of a sudden you can see your iPhone screen on your Mac. You can tell Codex, go into my iPhone on here and do blank, and it will scroll through and go do stuff if you have stuff that's only inside your iPhone.
Get out. Okay, hold on. So here we go. So right now, I have at the setup, there's the switching computer and then there's the media PC. So strangely, the MacBook Neo, I never hardly touch it because it mainly exists as a thing that I parsec into. It exists like this bit of hardware exists only for me to copy paste things in and out of here. So, okay. So, wow. Follow the instructions on, I bet. Oh, there we go. Whoa. Unable. Try again.
Yeah, I don't think so.
Yep. Wow. Well, this is a dangerous thing to do live.
What could go wrong?
Ready to use. Okay. Oh, and locked. Oh, wild. Okay.
Listen to the keystrokes, everybody. We'll hear Brian's.
Okay. Get ready for the horror show.
He's on his MacBook Neo is opening up his iPhone.
And use lock your iPhone to connect.
Yeah.
Okay.
So basically what works is you can have one open the other, your iPhone or the other one. So Brian is now basically connecting his MacBook to his iPhone.
This is the part that gives people anxiety is the 581,002 unread messages or the 1,203 voicemail messages.
Yeah.
This is crazy. That's bonkers. You guys want to see how I slept last night?
Literally, Brian, let me blow your mind for a moment. You ready? If the voicemail messages have transcripts, you can go into Codex now and say, hey, listen, go make sure the computer use is on. When you go click in there.
Can I press buttons on this or it's just showing it?
Yeah. No, you can press buttons, Brian.
Okay. Well, I'm clicking it, but it doesn't seem to. Oh, maybe opened. I'm clicking it wrong. How do I exit to the main menu?
I think you go back to the bottom and swipe up or there may be a. Oof. Now let me mirror mine too, Brian, so I can go do this alongside with you. But one thing you can do is think about you've got all of your iPhone messages and stuff in there.
Yeah.
Right. You could go in and tell Codex, can you go through and make a transcript, make a list of every message I haven't got back to and who it was from?
By the way, so, I won't say it. Man, my phone has been useless. Okay. In the marketplace, there are enough things you could do when you're making a major financial pivot, let's say buying or selling a house, that you put out enough statistical noise that data brokers you become an attractive target. And as though psychically, like, I've not been able to answer my phone. I can't answer my phone to anyone because so many robots are calling, offering to, they're either lying, saying your application, your loan, things that aren't relevant. Like, for the moment, for the next 2 weeks or so, there's no functional reason that I should expect anybody is who they claim to be on yeah. my phone. It's unreal. I just literally ignore everything. It's bonkers.
Yeah. So you can go in with Codex. So if you go back to your home screen, if you go bring your cursor just above the iPhone, like the home bar on there.
Oh,
on your iPhone, yeah, on the iPhone mirror, the mirror of the iPhone.
Okay. Well, oh, down here?
No, no, on the actual image of your iPhone, Brian.
Wait.
Go up.
Okay.
Okay. Bring it up, you know, see where on the right where you have the battery usage and all that is.
Oh, up here, up at the top.
Yeah, go higher. Now go higher.
Oh, got it.
There you go. See, now you can pop up that the icon to the left on the right edge to the left there. That'll bring you home if you're inside of an app.
Okay.
And the other one, if you go to the one to the right, will show you all your open windows, which you may not want to show on live.
I wonder, can you turn on the camera remotely? Probably not. That's crazy. Here, double click the clock.
Not available.
Oh, for some reason, I can't do it from the remote desktop app. I have to do it on the actual device. That's probably a good security thing to have.
Well, no, I'm to do what on the device?
Right now, so what you're seeing on the screen is...
Oh, your telemetry. Now, got
I'm remote accessing in. That's probably good.
Yeah.
That's crazy, man. I'll have to mess with all of that now.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So if you have apps or only on your iPhone, you can actually have Codex control it via MacBook.
That's nuts. Have you caught any of the robots making a boo-boo? Like that's the idea of doing anything unsupervised. I have yet to see how it does things enough. Like so far, all I've done is I said, I gave it the directive of you're logged in to YouTube, go through all the tabs, take all the screenshots of all the things. And then, because you can have it talk to other LLMs, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So if you're heavily tracking analytic stuff, and I'm sure there's an API thing that I could do if I knew more of that side of it, which I guess now there's a reason for me to learn. But basically tracking all the real-time analytics on a new YouTube video.
Are we not live anymore?
Yeah, we are.
Okay, good. Sorry, people were complaining. Go ahead.
Oh, got it. I lost the thread. At any rate, I had it go through
heavily monitoring analytics.
Yeah. I had it go and take screenshots of everything at various stages of the release to create kind of a dossier of trajectory, because there's a lot of things that won't display, like whatever they display right now. Maybe you wanted what it was 30 minutes ago, but there's no way to access that in terms of the velocity.
And you have been unsuccessful in doing that?
Oh, no. It was successful, but I was very nervous and watching it like a hawk the entire time because it was logged in to, you know, yeah, I read the headlines about entire companies getting liquidated because somebody just thought it would be okay to leave an unsupervised logged in robot.
Yeah, I mean, those stories usually have a little bit more to them than just, you know, the fox got into the hen house. But I do agree. I think that, like, there just needs to be, I'm sure there is already, a phenomenon of, like, I need to see a thing get done correctly three times before I will take my eye off it or I will trust it.
Yeah.
Like that is now the good news is with Codex, like I've gotten to that point. Like my little printout presidential daily briefing has been accurate and on time for weeks now. And but it took a while to get to a point where I would trust exactly what's on that piece of paper. Like I would double check everything.
Now that system exists, could you have your assistant write it? It's so great, man. 10 years ago, we were hypothesizing that this would be the day, and now it's real. I'm like, Justin, could you have your agent write a report on how it does, what it does, and send it to me?
so that my agent can read it and see what
I mean,
can be learned?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's... I don't know if I've said it on this show before, but when you really start screwing around with codecs, A, you understand why they're like, oh, this is the super app. Everything folds into this. This is the thing that matters. This is, you know, your interaction with the world will be through this point, because I don't think it's an app. I think it's an OS. I think it is the way that we are going to just interact with hardware. I think hardware is going to be built around these ideas. And that will just be the way that we interact with technology going forward. Like just constantly spinning sub agents that are doing things for us and bringing us things that, you know, the way that we understand technology now will just be, it'll always be there, but it will be underneath, you know, what we understand now. In the same way that the command line is underneath the graphical user interface today, this will just be the way that 99% of computer users interact with things. And then every once in a while, when you need to look for something specific, you can, you know, and the agent's being stupid, you can go find it your own way. But yeah, I mean, I think if to you know, for those of you who have not followed me on this brilliant journey, I created with Connectors a calendar and Gmail scraper every morning. Codecs will go look for that. It'll put it into a, along with the news of the day that I have from curated sources, and it'll put it together into a PDF that prints on my printer every morning at 6:30. And so, yeah, I think I should just be able to share that with you. I should just be able to say, oh, at Brian Brushwood, share this with at Brian Brushwood. You tell his agent how to do what I just did. Instead, I'll, you know, I don't know, say, hey, package up all the scripts that you wrote for me, anonymize them, and this send them
is,
to Brian.
This is one of those where rather than even doing that level of deciding, I've been trained to be all like, I want Brian to be able to do what I did. Guide, like I would outsource even the cognitive task of deciding how to get it, and instead ask, like, what would be a good way to get all the information?
Yeah.
Great, do it. And then, great, do it. And then evaluate output. Great, do it.
There was some meme I saw last week of just like, you know, a brainiac type figure with like his hands, you know, his fingers steepled together. It just says yes underneath it. And it's like me telling my vibe coding machine that like their next step is indeed should be taken or whatever. Cause that's, you know, it really do be like that sometimes.
Yeah.
I just sent you the link, which I'll put on a more stable URL at some point. But if you go in the lower left corner, Brian, you'll see a thing, the tiles. And it's basically every few minutes it changes which poster. I've got, I think, over 100 of these cool science posters. So if you go look at lower the very lower corner of your monitor there, it'll highlight and you can
click got it. Okay, I see now. Here, let me reset all of this. So, oh, there we go. So tiles. Oh, look at this. So what am I looking at?
I'm gonna click on one, Brian. Just see. Click on one.
London, 1844, 1854, cholera is killing hundreds. But what is the source? Dr. John Snow suspects the water. This is great. These are little adventures.
They're all infographics about cool, weird topics. So if you can click left or right, left, or you could set it to random. I have a 9x16 monitor next to my computer here. So I just have these periodically. It just shows, you know, some random science thing here. You know, it could be, you know, the two minds and one skull. You know, split brain stuff. I just, things that would make great weird things topics. Just literally, I get all of these things that come up. So it's from history and science. Sometimes I have things, I have like also writing stuff like how Michael Crichton writes. So I'm using the new GPT Image 2 model from OpenAI, just creating these really cool, like weird thing style infographics.
This is great. And because you've got kind of a random seed to it all, that probably when you're in writer mode, just nudges you in a surprising and interesting headspace, I'd imagine.
It's fun too, like just to sit back and look at something that pops up and think about a thing. So I've taken like kind of just a lot of my favorite topics, you know, and just keep going at it and say, come up with some more. And then every now and then it'll surprise me, like the Library of Oshkosh. Sometimes I'll prompt it. I'll say, hey, write something about this. But I'll say, give me a few of these different things here. My favorite one, terrifying one, how familiar are you with the idea of vacuum decay?
I don't know that one.
So in here, let me pull this up, is this idea that the energy state that we're in, that we may not actually be in the right level of, like, we might be like, if you look at like the energy state where we are, total vacuum, we might be in this area here, but there might be a deeper, lower level that all of a sudden some particles could tunnel through and all of a sudden burst it. And we could be in a state of basically the entire universe ceases to exist. You know,
wow.
Good night, everybody. That we're in a metastable universe that basically, if you look at the Higgs field, that all of a sudden something could tunnel through at some point and all of a sudden kind of collapse it and we fall to a lower, the true vacuum state, and all the matter, everything we know changes.
Isn't it funny how it's like the biggest of big problems and questions kind of boils down to, oh, so your big insight is we might die? Okay. Like,
well, but no, it's cool because it goes, if this is true, what else is true?
Yeah.
If we're not at the normal energy state, right? If we're, you know, the universe hyperexpanded, formed the way that it did, but there could be this other sort of this other wrinkle that then happens. That sort of like, you know, meanwhile, you know, we have this, you know, a tiny bubble of true vacuum begins to form and continues to expand at the speed of light. And then we get true vacuum, and then all of a sudden everything just changes and we're effed.
That's crazy. Hey man, I got a pick for you.
Okay.
It's a trailer for a thing that ain't out and ain't gonna be out until August. But what I love about it is one thing, and it's the fact that it is scarce and singular. Did you guys see the trailer for Knight Rider Declassified?
No.
What?
This is a 5-hour, 5-part documentary. Look at how it begins. Here, let's just go right to the beginning. There you go.
It's a Catherine Bach there and Daisy Dukes.
It's got a cover of the Knight
Rider. Television in the 80s was absolutely the cash cow for all the studios.
See, it's D'Souza. He retweeted
and
my wife's
number one
short
thing
film.
Was action.
It's part of the job. It's called show business. You put on a good show, you get good business.
We had so many shows that were action-oriented that were trying to do the same thing the Dukes of Hazzard had set the pace on.
During those years, it was just a very special, special time.
We really had the time of our lives, driving the car right into the ground.
Car work was at its heyday back then.
Everything had action in it.
Dude, and so...
damn, let's go!
You want to see a bunch of kits getting smashed? Like, that's my favorite part of this trailer, is you see the Night Industries 2000, like, leap over a car, and then you see it just smashed to pieces, and they're like, we killed so many cars! And I'm like, is that what's in this? So get this, if you go to Knight Rider Declassified, Knight Rider... Declassified.com, I think. Oh, not Knight Rider DC, I think, is what it is. KNIGHTRIDERDC.com. Nope.
And yeah, for our listeners, you have to understand, Brian and I are from an era where we fully expected to go to work for a mysterious foundation and driving a robot car across the American, you know, landscape solving crimes. This is a career path we both thought we were going
to
have.
Yeah. And instead we got very adjacent to it. But this 5-part series, get this, they got the bulk of it done. It's coming out in August and they're selling, they got David Hasselhoff. They got the voice of Kit. They got John Schneider. They got Catherine Bach. They got all the stunt coordinators, producers and stuff. And then now only on Blu-ray, never going to stream, never going to be anywhere else legally. $99. Let's go. Or for $199, you get fancier stuff. For $249, you get your name in the credits. For $599, you get a more important slot. And then eventually at like $5,000, they'll interview you and you'll be in the series. But it's like, and that's it. It's exactly what it looks like. The end. I'm like, this is so great. I'm so here for it.
Cool, guys. I'm a fan. I don't have a Blu-ray player and I don't care to find mine. So good luck.
Well, I'm certain that, you know, whatever, for the piracy layer, so, yeah, it'll be available instantly.
Yeah, no, this is, I mean, I am interested in the idea of this is a business model. I applaud them for trying to think outside the box. This is somewhere between a Kickstarter and a, you know, they probably have most of this documentary already shot.
There we go. It says here, region free with standard Blu-ray and digital streaming included. So you get it.
Okay. Yeah. There you go. All right.
I mean, look, at the end of the day, when you're at the merch booth, you'd like some merch, please. Not the idea of merch.
Yeah. It's very weird, though, because like our status in my head is like, oh, no, like, I don't know. I hope you would also be able to sell it to Netflix. I mean, maybe after it's all said and done, after 2 years, they'll, you know, license it or something like that.
I wouldn't be, I've done stuff that's limited edition stuff. And my goal there wasn't, and yes, I want to be the only one and I want to hoard over this like Gollum, like just knowing that, hey, it'll be a year or so before this appears on Netflix. That's fine. That's a great hook, you know, because a lot of it's this, because like, I think that, you know, making this, you know, I want other people to know the story. But great, great that they did this.
Yeah. And the 6-minute trailer, that alone is worth watching.
No, that looked awesome. My pick is an episode from season 2 of the NBC sitcom 30 Rock.
Oh, what's that? By the way, just sorry. So, if you look through the FAQ, is this a limited release? Yes, this is a one-time limited release, and the only time the complete 5-part documentary will be available with bonus features from Bert.
Ah, there we go. So, carve it up for parts. Have some 2-hour version of it that goes to Netflix. Fine, all of it's fine.
Oh, no. It'll be 5, but it just won't have the perks. So you still get the 5 episodes. So you know, tonnage. Tonnage sells, Bri. But no, good for them. I'm all for them figuring out a way that you can reward super fans and get them the project in an awesome, special way. I would hope that they make as much money on this as possible. The Hollywood's in a weird place, dude. It's in a weird, weird, weird place. Figure out the best way to get money. Season 2 of the NBC sitcom 30 Rock. It's called Rosemary's Baby. And it is an episode that I've always loved because it features Carrie Fisher, the late Carrie Fisher, who was a hilarious actress, as well as, of course, Princess Leia and a great writer. But she plays a famous writer from the 60s that Liz Lemon adores. And so the A plot is Liz Lemon hiring this 60s writer and realizing that, you know, there is a reality to her hero worship. And it has spawned a line that Andrew and I have said to each other probably hundreds of times at this point, which is, relax, Liz, it's the 90s, whenever something weird is happening. But I did not realize that the B plot of that episode is a clip that every once in a while gets surfaced to me on like Reels or X or whatever. And it is a therapy scene between Jack Donaghy, played by Alec Baldwin, and Tracy Jordan, played by Tracy Morgan, where Tracy Jordan is realizing that much of his behavior is caused by his absentee relationship with his father. And it ends with Alec Baldwin playing through hilarious racial stereotypes. Tracy Morgan's absentee father, his mother, the white man that married Tracy Morgan's mother, the Puerto Rican neighbor upstairs. It's a tour de force scene. It's very, very funny. 30 Rock. I'm not the first person to say it's a very funny show, but that episode specifically is like, put it in the Louvre. Just a perfect sitcom episode.
It's It was so, Haldeman was the mailbox, you know, like literally there's just, it was great. Cause like, you know, Carrie Fisher's like day drinking and Liz is getting a hotter case about it. And like, relax, Liz, it's the '90s. The beloved Carrie Fisher, who was a talent, it was just way more than we realized. And it was a great episode to see that. Like you said, the other plots like there, it's just, that was just, you walked away from going, why can't we have more Carrie Fisher and stuff too?
I know, right? I mean, obviously she had her own demons that probably capped her career, but good God, at that point it's like you look at that performance and then you see somebody like Catherine O'Hara, who had such an amazing role on like The Studio. Now she is dearly departed as well, but it's like, man, there wasn't like, we couldn't have got one Carrie Fisher run on like one of those prestige television shows, or those like when sitcom comedies still really were like humming in the 2000s. Like, man, that would have been awesome.
So my literary agent was really good friends with her. So I got to ask her, I got to ask Erica about that. Like, you know, why not more?
Because she would have been in that Catherine O'Hara space. I mean, not to say that Catherine O'Hara is anything other than a singularly hilarious comedy person, but it's like when she had Schitt's Creek, it was like, oh, just clear the way. She's an icon. She was amazing in The Studio. God, it would have been great to see Carrie Fisher just tee off on a role like that. But
yeah.
Oh well.
All right. Brian, if a friend of yours who is religious says, hey, Brian, I want you to come to my church. They're going to play a movie. I think you might like it. And it was a movie about an apostle or something like that. And you would judge it just for that, right?
Well, sure. I mean, as opposed to...
Be like, it's fake or this or that. Or I remember the whale.
You're asking if I'd get all skeptic-y about it.
Or just bring, like, I saw that, remember Whale Rider? I love Whale Rider. And, like, Whale Rider's great. Like, I don't have to believe in this sort of, you know, this Pacific Islander mythology to enjoy it. You know, like Mona or what, you can have icons, you can have people. I can watch a thing, you know, if somebody's like, oh, the Scientologists have a great documentary about L. Ron Hubbard, you should go watch it there. I'm going to go watch, like, all right, I get it. They're not going to go and be like, you know, let me tell you the real Hubbard.
This guy was a fraud.
Yeah. You know, I'd be like, all right, cool. I'm going to judge it on those grounds. And so I think sometimes we walk into a thing and say, I'm going to judge it on its own grounds and say, I'm just going to go. I know what I'm going into. I'm not going to stand out there and say, hey, you know, I watched, you know, the Elton John biopic, Rocket Man. Like, there's a lot of stuff. You know, if I watched one about Led Zeppelin, I'd be like, they're great. But man, I know there are stories about them too. I'm like, I will just accept it because it's about the music and all that. Right?
Yeah, sure. So what did you see?
I really liked Michael. I really liked the Michael Jackson movie. One member of our household is a big, huge fan of his, and I've had these very much back and forth. I'm like, well, there's this.
If you have never gotten into a conversation with Andrew's wife about Michael Jackson, just know that you have not seen True Passion. There are many things for which she has conviction. I don't know if she has conviction on anything up to and including her marriage to Andrew, the likes of which she has conviction for defending Michael Jackson.
But she'll also go like, I know that I'm a fan. And so she'll do that. She will entertain that idea. But anyhow, and rightfully said, he was never convicted of anything.
Never convicted. Never convicted. That is true.
Never convicted of stuff.
In a court of law. Court of public opinion, different story. A
lot of compelling people out there. Went into the Michael Jackson movie, Michael. When I first saw the trailer, I'm like, I thought Jafar Jack's thought the nose looked weird. I'm like, whatever, go see this. I walked out of that theater, a huge fan of Jafar Jackson, Michael Jackson's nephew who played Michael in it, is his performance. Colin Domingo's Joe Jackson performance is great. I enjoyed it thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed that movie. Absolutely enjoyed the movie. And they start it, you know, his childhood. They end it on the Bad Tour, which is right before things went
not great.
Bad. And so it is, they, you know, it's 2 hours long. He is a guy that has incredibly rich life. There's so much stuff, a lot of stuff they left out, but a lot of other stuff too. Like there's so many other things there, but I thought for like, did I enjoy it? Did I get it? If you liked the music, you know, and you want to hear a version of the story, really liked it.
Yeah.
They play the good songs.
Yeah, I was about to say, probably a pretty good soundtrack, I'm going to guess.
Yeah. Look, the music survived. I don't care what you believe about Michael Jackson. The music never went away. You know, it's still a part of the American framework.
Yeah.
Worldwide, global icon, Michael Jackson. End that story right at the Bad Tour. And then everything else happened. The end. Michael Jackson will appear in Infinity War.
It's all Weird Al parodies from here.
Yeah. No, we're doing the sequel. It's done huge. I mean, the audience, it's funny because the Rotten Tomatoes audience score is like 98%. Like at the theater I was in, people were singing, people were dancing afterwards. It was a very, very,
it's a massive very fun hit. Time. No, it's a huge hit. It's a massive hit. And, you know, we did a whole series, Will Saddleberg and I, on musical biopics. And when you look back at like the history of them, there's one lesson: simple plot. The person sings the songs. You just make sure that those performances are well done and compelling. It's weirdly an awards factory. Musical biopics, they are often reviled, and yet they are such big hits, and you wind up getting compelling character actor performances with roles that people have a previous emotional connection to, that they wind up getting disproportionately nominated for awards. And, you know, wouldn't be shocked if Jafar Jackson or Coleman Domingo get nominated. There's not that many movies that are going to come out that have that level of attention put on it.
I walked in being highly, highly skeptical. I walked out going, yeah, and this is Jafar's first role. He'd done some music videos and some music stuff. And then the producers, the same producers that did like Bohemian Rhapsody and do that, they spent like 2 years with him, working on him, getting him into being able to do the role and be able to do the performance. And it's great. It's a version, you know, it's a version of Michael, but it's a believable version. And rather be here telling you what terrible movie it was and just this, but I'm like,
gotta be starting something.
Gotta be. Yeah. As dangerous as it may be, gentlemen, it's been weird.